Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In his victory speech last night, President-elect Donald Trump paused to consider his rival, the one he promised, if elected, to hound with special investigations and throw in jail. Hillary, he said, had worked very hard over many years. He said, we owe her a major debt of gratitude for her service to our country. And he said he meant that sincerely. It's the day after the 2016 election and the voters have spoken. Republicans still control Congress and now the Oval Office. Today, we're talking about how the election unraveled for Hillary Clinton, how the polls went wrong, and what Donald Trump has promised to do as president. Later in this hour, Clinton is scheduled to address her supporters in New York. We'll hear that as well. Joining us is Ohio State University historian and law professor David Stebbin. Welcome back, David.
Good morning.
And also Columbus Dispatch Washington correspondent Jessica Wehrman. Welcome back, Jessica.
Thanks for having me.
Folks, questions or comments, give us a call. You know the tone of the show, so make sure we maintain that. 614-292-8513. Donald Trump made a lot of promises, including to have Clinton investigated. How do you think he'll follow or not on that, David Stebbin? What does that even mean anymore?
Well, I think some of this may turn out to be sort of the bluster of the campaign. And he has so many other things to deal with now that he's the winner that he may just decide to drop that sort of thing. We'll find out. The tone of his remarks last night were in no way confrontational.
Right.
Nothing that suggested he bore any animus towards her. What it showed is that he knows how to be a good winner, right? The question before last night was, would he be a gracious loser? And no one knew, but now we'll never know because he won. So if he's a gracious winner, that would help unite a country that is divided. And the other thing I think that's motivating him not to go too far in the direction of continuing to fight with the other side is it seems likely that she will have won more popular votes. So
yeah,
he doesn't have much of a popular mandate. Now, in our system, the Electoral College tally is the deciding factor. But if you look at surveys of ordinary public opinion in today's 21st century America, a substantial majority of Americans think that the person who gets the most popular votes really ought to be the president. That's the legitimate winner. Mm-hmm. So that hangs over him. In a way, it's even worse because he's also under 50% as well as behind her. So he doesn't really have a normal mandate. And so that will inhibit, I think, him from doing divisive things.
You are listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's the day after Election Day. Donald Trump is the next president of the United States. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Jessica Wehrman, even already on Facebook, I'm seeing, you know, I've got lots of different people I follow and follow me on Facebook. And I hear lots of different points of view. And Trump supporters are saying throw her in jail.
They are. And actually, last night when he actually thanked her for her public service during his victory speech, there were reportedly chants of lock her up. Now, I was watching that on TV. I'm here in Ohio. I was not in New York. I did not see that firsthand. However, I'm seeing reports of that. I'm trusting that the people who were there are reporting that accurately. I don't think you can possibly underestimate the amount of animus that's towards her, the amount of sort of the amount of vitriol towards her that remains. I don't know that he locks her up. I don't know really. I think the thing with Trump is basically he's kind of a blank book. We don't really know what he's going to do. I mean, he's talked about a lot of things, but I found a real challenge in reporting on his stances where sometimes things were moving targets. For a while, he talked about banning Muslims from the country. Then he was not talking about that. There were sometimes conflicting things on what he said. So we really don't know what to expect out of a Trump presidency. We just have to watch it unfold.
So it appears, as you mentioned, David Stebbin, that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote. And although the GOP retained control of Congress, it is by narrow margins, narrower margins, actually.
Correct.
So not exactly a mandate on either score. Any president-elect would have trouble moving forward with such a thin a veneer of support. But he's made a lot of promises, and I'm wondering about the people who supported him. They're not one of the things that spurred them to do this was they were sick and tired of no change in Washington.
Correct. And I think he meant what he said about many of his major public policy initiatives. The question, of course, is will he be able to act on those promises, carry them out? And there are some things that he can do. For example, he's talked a lot about renegotiating trade agreements, and Congress gave the president a lot of discretion to cancel trade agreements. He doesn't need Congress as much to change the nation's trade policy. But he does need Congress to do other kinds of things that he might – appropriating the money to build the wall, so to speak, if he really wants to strengthen the border with Mexico would require huge sums of money. And it's not clear that the congressional Republicans or the Democrats would go along with that. The congressional Republicans would be concerned somewhat about the cost, the Democrats about the message it sends to Mexico and so on. So the really interesting thing to watch – will he identify a few top priorities? Because there's a long list of promises.
Yeah.
And if he does he pick the things that he has the most control over directly? Executive orders, things like that. And if you'll recall, President Obama, because he's been frustrated with Congress, has done more with executive orders. Mm-hmm. And they can be changed. So does he busy himself early on with that? And then try the harder lift of getting major changes in tax policy or spending policy out of Congress? We'll find out.
What sort of things, you know, from where you sit in Washington, D.C., Jessica Wehrman, do you see him doing quickly?
I'm trying to think. I think that the wall was a priority. So I think that there will be some semblance of immigration reform. What that looks like, I don't know. I mean, they're in practice, a lot of these things are incredibly hard to enforce.
Yeah.
Deporting 11 million people from this country. I mean, how do you pay for that? How do you begin to do that? How do you execute that? I think that we can definitely expect to see some of President Obama's executive actions revoked. And, you know, I think that you'll see some regulatory reform, some peeling back of reform pretty quickly. Let's look at what the doable is. Now, the thing is, on paper, he's got a majority of Congress. He's got the Senate mm-hmm. and the House. They both won last night. So if you're looking at any other Republican president, you're going, this guy's got it all sort of laid out for him. However, he's not your typical Republican. He is very much in conflict with his own party on a number of issues. So I don't really see – I don't see a kumbaya moment. I think Obamacare would be something that you might see everybody agree would have to be radically changed or probably repealed in some fashion. That seems to me.
But do they have enough votes for a repeal?
Right now, it looks very possible. It looks much more possible than it did, you know, yesterday.
Joanne in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Joanne.
Hi. I just wanted to talk about the polls. Mm-hmm. I've heard a lot of people talk about the polls, but the critical thing, as far as I'm concerned, is that a bunch of us have caller ID and never, ever answer the phone. And then, of course, everyone has talked about how a lot of people have cell phones. I do, too. I have both. But so many of us don't answer the polls. So I haven't believed the polls ever since I got caller ID and half the other people have caller ID.
Well, I mean, that's a thing, David Stebbin. What about the polling? I mean, the polling was statistically correct. It wasn't.
Well, the thing about the polling
but is, it was wrong.
It was wrong. And the American political system and the British one use a common polling expert community. And the last British general election in 2015 was the biggest upset since 1945. This morning, we can confidently say that the American outcome is the biggest polling upset since 1948, when Harry Truman was behind in every published poll and still prevailed. And 1945 in Britain and 1948 in America were similar election cycles. So in other words, the Americans have done, in a way, what the British did. In other words, given a result that none of the polls predicted in mm-hmm. advance, or almost none. And so why is that? One is exactly what the caller has astutely pointed out.
Technology.
There are lots of people who've given up landlines. Then there are the people like myself who still has a landline but almost never answers it because there's no real world person I want to talk to.
Right.
So the old model of doing telephone surveys doesn't work anymore. The response rates were in the single digits and have been for the past few years. So you can try to compensate for that. I asked people who know about this, very distinguished polling experts, said, well, before there was reliable landline telephone polling, they did house to house or apartment to apartment. They sent human pollsters to knock on doors. So, well, why can't they go back to that? Because it is prohibitively expensive. Mm-hmm. It would change the whole cost structure of polling in a way that would make it very difficult for most polls to continue. So what I emphasized when I spoke to groups this year, and the most recent one was to the Hispanic Law Group at their annual gala in Columbus, was that we have become accustomed to thinking that the polls describe reality. But given the structural problems with polling, we could not be confident that what we thought we knew was true. And the result has confirmed that.
The Trump campaign often referred to a quiet branch of support that would not be reflected in the polls. Jessica Wehrman, is this a real thing?
I believe it is. Yeah. I mean, we can't help but think. I was fascinated watching the exit polls. And exit polls are a different animal.
Right.
You poll actual live people as they are leaving the polls. Right. I mean, as they're leaving the election sites. So you would think that those might be more accurate. And I was reading those thinking last night, this looks pretty good for her. You saw you did see a strong desire for change, but you also saw a real emphasis on experience as well. You saw a deep divide among women and men voters. You saw a deep divide among minority and white voters. And the thought was, based on those exit polls, it looks pretty good for her. And then as the night went on, it certainly didn't. I keep thinking back to 2000, and I remember
the hanging chads.
Hanging chads, and everybody criticized TV networks for calling it too soon. So in the aftermath of that, there was almost sort of an abundance of caution. Mm-hmm. People did not want to call presidential states, you know, before it was time. And that you saw that last night, actually. I mean, there were a lot of Midwestern states.
All you had to do was look at their faces, to know they were getting and seeing things and hearing things that they
were
talking
about. And
even
if you looked at Wisconsin, you're thinking, it's going to be pretty hard for her to make that up.
Yeah.
So I wonder what, you know, whether that sort of navel-gazing or that sort of examination of calling states too early will be reflected actually with exit polls and with polling this time. I wonder if there will be a real revisitation of how we do what we do in terms of trying to figure out what the public sentiment is.
Nate Silver from 538 said that Hillary Clinton had an 85% chance.
He did, yeah.
But he also said that she had a 15% chance of losing then. That Trump, you know, that's the way he styles it. And so he always wins, you know. He always, you know, that Trump tapped into that 15% opportunity. Yeah, he's always safe. You know, there's always a chance that there's going to be an upset in his world. And, but the 15 that Trump was able to tap into that 15% opportunity. Well, I guess it shows in the white hot dead heat between mm-hmm. him, really, in the popular vote.
I mean, I really think that there was just everything about this that you would ordinarily predict based on past history.
Yeah.
You know, if past is prologue, he defied all expectations. He said probably 30, 40 things that would really make any other candidate toast. I mean, he was a candidate who was sort of alienating large groups of voters. 51% of the voting populace is women. But he defied expectations in every way. I remember that primary. He came in a long shot and he kept knocking off the state. So basically the theme of this election was expect the unexpected.
Joanne, thanks a lot for that call. We are going to continue our conversation. And as promised, when Hillary Clinton addresses her supporters in New York, it's supposed to be around 10:30. We will turn to that as well. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. President-elect Donald Trump has made a lot of promises during his campaign. He promised to repeal the Affordable Care Act. He promised to build a wall between the U.S. and Mexico. He promised to have Hillary Clinton investigated for allegedly breaking the law regarding her email server. He also called for changes to U.S. trade policy, big changes. So there's lots to talk about. Coming up around 10:30, Hillary Clinton is scheduled to address her supporters for the first time since the election was called in favor of Donald Trump. We'll turn to that when that occurs. Still with us is OSU historian and law professor David Stebbin and also Columbus Dispatch Washington correspondent Jessica Wehrman. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. David Stebbin, briefly, let's go back to this polling issue. You're talking Hillary Clinton is going to continue to accrue votes in the win category, but that will not change.
Correct.
In the final.
Most likely, can't be certain, but most likely the margin by which she has won the national popular vote will grow because of mail-in ballots and provisionals. And the pattern in the last several election cycles since 2000 has been the Democrats tend to net significantly more. In 2012, a lot more. And so it's possible, I suppose, that this time could be different and Donald Trump actually does better in the votes tabulated after today, but most likely her margin will grow, which is a strange phenomenon. In other words, her total popular vote will grow, but not in the places that can help her win to change the outcome.
In the states to change the electoral outcome.
Yeah, California and New York will be there.
Right.
Right, exactly. Donald Trump has a campaign team. That's pretty much it. He has Rudolph Giuliani and Chris Christie, I guess, and a bunch of retired military generals. Who does he stock his government with? Because he's the first time someone who's never held office or been in the military has been elected president of the United States. I'm wondering, Jessica, how that might work.
I literally have no idea. I mean, I think, he has a certain group of allies and he has advisors, but I mean, it's a small team. It's kind of a, sort of insulated to Trump world in a way.
Yeah, right.
So, and I think maybe that was probably part of the reason why some of the establishment was so nervous. Here was a man who has never served in public office before. He doesn't really know, he doesn't really know a lot of these Washington
insiders.
Something
like 40,000 appointments.
Yeah, it's going to be stunning. I mean, there are so many different storylines that are going to be revealed with this, that are going to unveil themselves. It's hard to even know where to begin. I have no idea who will be in his camp. Will it be the people that have supported him? I would imagine so.
Well, and he has a business background. Mm-hmm. He's not very impressed by professional politicians.
Right.
And the last president like that, in terms of having that attitude and having it affect his appointments, was Dwight Eisenhower, mm-hmm. whose cabinet was full of distinguished people who had served in other realms. There were very few professional politicians in the Eisenhower cabinet. And so he could take that route and so hire business leaders and so on, military
folks.
People
from academia?
Well, there is a world of conservative academia. Mm-hmm. If he wanted to go that route, he could certainly do so. So I suspect that the second and third and fourth tier appointments might be more conventional and he relies on Governor Pence and Paul Ryan and others to suggest names. But for the top people around him, I suspect he's not going to pick sort of longtime Republican political types. He'll want other kinds of people.
What about his handling of his business matters? Again, not an issue we often think about in terms of a president-elect, but in his case, he has said he's going to hand off his business to his son, mm-hmm. his children, and that's not exactly the way it usually works, right, Jessica?
It's kind of hard to imagine how he would do this. This man is a consummate businessman. This is a man who has made his living off of his own name. So this is one of the question marks. I keep feeling like I'm telling you, I don't know. But there are so many elements of this that we just don't know how it's going to play out. I would imagine he would. But, the thing is, he actually could continue this. There's a lot of things that if he's proven anything, it's that there's certain amounts of conventional wisdom he is willing to defy, and he doesn't really care if he's irritating people. I think that's probably part of the reason he was very refreshing to a lot of voters, is because there is a certain stick-your-thumb-in-the-eye kind of attitude that they really appreciate.
Are there questions, though, since he used so much of his campaign to benefit his personal business? Are there questions or concerns that he might try to do that with government?
I think that would probably be a valid line of questioning, but that so would be why hasn't he, released the tax returns, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah,
it's a story, but that doesn't mean
anything will happen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Russians were celebrating Trump's victory last night, but maybe not China. He's threatened to levy high tariffs on Chinese imports at times up to 45%.
Right.
What does he, you know, does he have power over something like that? Is that an executive type of...
The trade arrangements give the president a lot of discretion. So that's the way they were structured.
Mm-hmm.
No one really envisioned this scenario, but here we are. And I think, you know, the Russian leader is a very much an alpha male who likes the use of force. And I think he sees Donald Trump as potentially a kindred spirit. So, in other words, under a Trump administration, America will man up and literally produce more force to solve certain problems in the Middle East. I have no idea if that's the case. But I think the Russians are also sort of surprised, this, you know, by this outcome because it wasn't predicted by the official establishment. It's a very – there are a lot of unknowns. But I, my own feeling is as long as the Republicans control both houses of Congress, we are not likely to have a lot of investigations of Donald Trump's business dealings and the like.
No.
So it isn't going to be like the Clinton Foundation had
right.
she won. He employs lawyers all the time. So he'll just get a bunch of legal opinions. You can do this. You can't do that. But I think Jessica's put her finger on it. The Trump brand mm-hmm. is central to his business success. And that makes the children the logical people because they also have the Trump name, even if they're not him.
Mm-hmm.
Whether they can draw enough lines between the children and the dad so that they can actually function in their separate spheres without
right.
creating conflicts of interest, we've never tried to do this before.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, his self-confidence, his independence stems in part from the fact that he is now the wealthiest person ever to be president. In other words, he doesn't need wealthy donors.
We think.
We don't know.
Right.
I mean,
well, John F. Kennedy was the record holder before.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it seems likely that even on the low end side, he's still richer, adjusted for inflation, than John F. Kennedy was when he was mm-hmm. elected in 1960. So he's a very wealthy man. How wealthy is a little unclear. And that gives him a somewhat greater amount of autonomy from pressures of various kinds, which is one of the things his supporters like the most. He doesn't have to cave to certain interest groups.
Never underestimate the power of even the illusion of candor. You know, people
right.
really love a straight talker, and I think that was a great part of his appeal because, you know, he didn't really care what people thought. I mean, he would say these things and get criticized, and I mean, I don't know that he really apologized, maybe once or twice, but...
But the point is that he said a lot of things that any other candidate... including in this cycle,
yeah.
had said would be toast. And the same people who voted for him, would they have tolerated the same things coming out of another candidate's
mouth? There was the persona that he kind of came into this with, and that sort of shielded him in a lot of ways.
Yeah. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It looks like Hillary Clinton's remarks have been pushed back to about 11 o'clock. Of course, whenever they occur, we will turn to that and then we'll continue our conversation afterward. If you have a question or comment now, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. The peso dropped like a rock last night. Trump has promised to charge a 35% tax on goods from Mexico. A lot of people really are concerned about our relationship with that country. It hasn't always been that great. It was interesting when I was working on a show about World War I recently. I didn't know that the Germans had tried to negotiate a deal for Mexico to invade the United States, or they wanted at least to get them
That's
on their
right.
side. And so the point being that, you know, it's an uneasy.
The German government thought the Mexican government would be receptive because the Americans had invaded militarily Mexico, chasing so-called bandits. So General Pershing, who becomes internationally famous as the leader of American forces in Europe during World War I, in 1915 and 16 is pursuing Mexican outlaws.
Is this Pancho?
The point is, the argument of the Wilson administration was, if you cannot control your own internal marauders, we will send the U.S. Army to do it for you. And that is a very traumatic thing for the Mexican people. I have visited Mexico.
They remember.
Correct. And it's in their history books and mm-hmm. so on. So the I mean, we have a similarly fraught relationship with Canada in
right.
some ways. So the one of the big questions is what he will do immediately once he's president about the 11 million undocumented.
Yeah.
And the thing to understand about that is many of them are related to people who are legal.
Mm-hmm.
So you're talking about literally dividing up family, deporting grandma who's undocumented while the grandchildren stay, that sort of thing. And
yeah.
that's a very traumatic idea. So among the
and
most—
just the logistical—
Well, it would be a huge undertaking.
And
right.
who pays for that?
Right. Yeah.
And who back to Jessica, who's
well, but if you make
it?
If you make it really hard for those folks to function in American society, I mean, you can imagine an approach that denies them driver's licenses and access to public school. I mean, just go down. Then this was sort of what Governor Romney talked about 4 years ago. If you make life unpleasant enough here, they'll go home by themselves. So, but even that.
My understanding is, though, that immigration is actually – illegal
down.
Immigration is actually down.
And that was because of the economy since 2008,
well,
actually.
Also,
it might be upticking a little bit.
Well,
there's
also
jobs.
Increased deportations. Right.
right.
In other words, but the point is there's this huge pool of people. So
still.
Even if net we have no new migration, which I think is the case, we're no longer gaining. But we have this pool of 11 million people.
Yeah.
Is he serious? Is one of these unanswered questions.
How do you do that, you know?
Right. But if you make life very miserable for
yeah.
those folks, and I'm not advocating that. In other words, I'm trying to understand
how it's
right.
done.
He's not said that either.
Correct.
He has not suggested
right.
how he would do it in the first place.
No.
Jeremiah in Westchester, you're on the air. Hi, Jeremiah.
Hi. How are you doing today?
Pretty good.
Good. I was calling in because I wanted to say that I think a lot that can be attributed to Donald Trump's victory is the fact that he had the evangelicals on his side, primarily because of the list of the Supreme Court justices that he would appoint that would overturn Roe versus Wade. And I was watching an interview recently of Julian Assange from WikiLeaks,
mm-hmm.
and he was laying out the case how pretty much the entire world and the entire system is against Donald Trump, except perhaps the evangelicals. And I really think that Jesus Christ himself has answered a lot of our prayers, and the evangelical vote has come together to see that Donald Trump would win.
That's clear. I mean, that the evangelical vote went that direction. Jeremiah, thanks for your call. But despite other concerns they might have.
Right. Well, among the things that succeeded, Governor Pence was a good selection mm-hmm. because he was a very good emissary
right.
to that community. The emphasis on Supreme Court appointments. Mm-hmm. At a minimum, what Donald Trump promised was, I'll replace Scalia with someone like Scalia. In other words, that the Supreme Court's current makeup will not change. Balance of power. If I'm here long enough and I get more vacancies, then I can actually push the court in a more Scalia-esque direction. It's unclear whether he'll have any more openings.
Right.
But I have not seen how many evangelical Christians, self-identified white, voted for
We don't
Donald
actually
Trump.
Know that for
I don't
sure.
I was thinking about the exit polls, and I'd not seen anything about evangelicals. But I do know. I mean, I actually come from a part of Ohio that's sort of a very conservative Catholic part of Ohio. And the concern was really all over Supreme Court justice. I think the
right.
campaign did a very effective job
yeah.
of saying, okay, he is thrice divorced. Or no, he's been divorced twice. He's remarried. But he would probably have a better chance of appointing or nominating a Supreme Court justice that would be on your side than she would. And I think that was enough. That for them, I think that was sufficient.
Another caller, someone else called in. We didn't get to their call before they hung up, but they wanted to talk about veterans and the voice of veterans in this election and said that there was a strong veteran piece to all of this. And
yes.
I had not necessarily heard that. David Stebbin?
Right. They respond very positively to a Make America Great kind
okay.
of message.
Okay.
To them, it brings back a memory of the United States as it was in the post-World War II period.
Mm-hmm.
This great big military presence in the world, highly respected. And it's also a very male group. It tends to be an older group now because we hadn't produced as many veterans in recent decades. And he resonated really well with that group. They're patriotic, almost by definition. And his campaign was patriotic in a very traditional sense.
Except he said things like that he wanted, always wanted to have a Purple Heart, but he got every deferment he could, you know, wrap his arms around during the Vietnam War. I mean,
right.
he seemed to have it both ways.
Well, his traditional invocation of 1950s, 60s America mm-hmm. as a great time to be alive resonates really well with Greatest Generation men
okay.
who served. And in fairness to Donald Trump, he grew up in that era. He's old.
He's the oldest president we'll have ever.
Right. Slightly.
Walking into the Oval Office.
Right. Slightly older than Ronald Reagan when he was elected. Mm-hmm. And utterly sincere. Even the immigration issue. In the New York City world of the 1960s, the overwhelming majority of residents of New York City were born in this country. In other words, when Donald Trump turned 21 in 1967, there were about 200 million Americans, spot on, according to the census. 95% of them were born in this country, approximately. The highest ever, right? In other words, he's an unusual – his childhood was unusual because never were there more native-born Americans. And of the 5% that was foreign-born, they were predominantly elderly, grandma and grandpa from the old country. And so his vision of what a great New York was like, more united because it had all of these disparate ethnic groups and so on. But what was happening to them, they were all gradually being assimilated, having been born in the country mostly, into one great big, reasonably homogeneous middle class. And when he talks that way, there are lots of older people who respond positively to that message. I'm writing a book about America from the 30s through the 60s. Huh. And it's called Making a Middle Class Nation. And that he is nostalgic. In other words, the most interesting part of his slogan, Make America Great Again, to an historian is the last word, again.
Again, right. Right. Oh, yes, right.
He has a
right.
vision of the past that he wants to make the future.
And I think it reflects sort of a deeper discontent or concern about how quickly, you know, America is changing, how quickly our social norms are changing, you know, from everything from gay marriage to the, you know, the transgender bathroom. I mean, this is a very radical change for some elements of America. Or and also not just that issue. It's as well as, you know, the fact that we are rapidly growing. We're rapidly diversifying country. And I think that that, you know, I think that that speaks to some unease about how quickly things are changing. It's I mean, it's very whiplash inducing.
You know, speaking of what David Stubbin just said about, you know, from the 30s to the 60s, you know, had a big part of what built the middle class in this country were unions. And they did not support their traditional Democrat.
To me, the single most interesting takeaway from this election was the union vote and the industrial Midwest.
Agreed.
Because I was watching the whole time Mahoning County, Youngstown. That is typically a very solid Democratic stronghold because of union workers. In 2012 and 2008, Obama won it by 26%.
Right.
Last night, Clinton only won it by 3%.
Right.
That was astonishing. Elsewhere, she also lost Montgomery County, which is home to Dayton.
Well, same with Michigan. I mean, if you look up at
Michigan,
Wayne County,
Pennsylvania, this is the industrial Midwest.
Right.
These have been and what is going to be the challenge for Democrats is to get that cache of voters back. We already saw something else change in Ohio. We saw southeast Ohio, the coal miners, traditionally sort of union, traditionally sort of blue collar workers. They've already migrated to Republicans, voting Republicans into Congress, going overwhelmingly for Rob Portman. Now we're seeing the union workers sort of move too. And that's because of his populist message, I think. I mean, he really spoke in sort of the man's getting us down kind of way.
Well, and those jobs in factories and in coal were heavily held by men with no more than a grade school education. Mm-hmm. And for many years, they paid a decent living wage.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And the total number of jobs like that has declined drastically since the 90s. And so especially since 2000. In other words, good-paying factory jobs in Ohio that you can sort of support a family on, the total number of those has gone down a lot. And so the trouble with the Clinton brand is it's closely associated with the kinds of trade deals that help make that happen. Mm-hmm. And so she really labored under this huge burden in trying to win blue-collar votes in Ohio.
They remember NAFTA. They remember it very clearly. And, I mean, they held it against her, I think.
One of the most informative things I've ever done was in 1994, Ross Perot came to town to speak against NAFTA, and he filled the Visitor Center, what do you call it, the Convention Center auditorium. And just as an observer, I went because I teach modern American political history. Fascinating, wonderful bands, songs you could remember. If you vote for NAFTA, we'll remember long after. In other words, and it was full of a demographic you don't often see in the news media and so on of these sort of people who felt vulnerable. And it's 22 years later, and they have been.
We are going to continue our conversation. Once again, we'll break whenever Hillary Clinton enters the stage in New York to address her supporters. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We are talking about the election yesterday. We now have a president-elect, Donald Trump, who will take over in the new year. It's a big change, a big surprise to a lot of people. The polls had them in a statistical dead heat, though. And Hillary Clinton actually does have a advantage in the popular vote, but that does not translate to the necessary number of electoral votes. Donald Trump is by and away the big winner in that department. Still with me, Jessica Wehrman, Washington correspondent for the Columbus Dispatch, and also David Stebbin, Ohio State University historian and professor of law at Moritz College of Law. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. And a reminder that we will turn to Hillary Clinton when she takes the podium in New York to address her supporters about this. Wayne in Dayton, you're on the air. Hi, Wayne.
Yes, who would have known that Chicago Cubs would win the World Series and Donald Trump would have been president of the United States?
Yeah.
I think one of the biggest losers was the television networks and the pundits. In fact, my concern is who would ever trust some of the prognosticators on the networks ever again? On any presidential campaign. I think the network's going to have to reconsider who their hosts are and also who their pundits are. Hmm.
David Stubbin, you're nodding.
I am. In other words, one of the really interesting, eye-grabbing statistics was how well Donald Trump did with people who did not earn a college degree. If you look at the pundit world and the media world, there was a time, you've been a working journalist, Anne, when there were a whole lot of reporters who had no more than a high school education and so on. And then in the 60s and 70s and 80s, that really changed.
Thanks to Watergate.
Right. And so there's this overwhelming college-educated brand group of national journalists and pundits now. And some of them come from humbler backgrounds and have been around regular working folks. But a lot of them, it's been too long, or they're in isolation, or they never were around those people. Among the most humbled, for example, and he's not a doctrinaire person, he's a kind of middle-of-the-road guy, is David Brooks, who has written so many obituaries for the career of Donald Trump. It's embarrassing. I feel for this man.
Because he just looked – he was ashen last night. There's no other way to describe him.
I'm feeling okay because –
New York Times columnist, of course, for those – and he was on PBS NewsHour with their team covering the election last night.
Right. And – my spouse and I talk about these issues, and she said, you know, he really ought to come out to Columbus and spend a weekend with you because you were predicting that Donald Trump had a very good chance to win the nomination, and then he did. And you kept emphasizing these polls were kind of hard to predict and they were unreliable. Mm-hmm. But poor old David Brooks sits in Manhattan. I lived there for 10 years. I did my law degree and my PhD at Columbia. I'm utterly familiar with life in Manhattan. It is as bubbly, as different from middle America as you can imagine. And so David Brooks, to his credit, after he messed up in the primaries, drove around and visited middle America. But even so, he went back home and still didn't get it right. So your caller is absolutely correct. They do need to diversify somewhat who they have on those shows.
Yeah. I mean, I do look at this and go, okay, so – The other thing you cannot underestimate is the degree to which all the rules changed this cycle.
Right.
If you go to Washington, which is where I am based now, I am from Ohio, but I live in Washington or the Washington suburbs now. You live around a group of people who have been around politics, who have seen sort of trends, who again use past information to predict the future. But Trump rewrote the rules.
Right.
And so I think you can't underestimate that, the degree to which he just sort of surprised people. Now, I found it very illuminating to be in Ohio this last week because, I mean, I spent a lot of the time in northern Ohio, which was sort of a Clinton stronghold. But sort of seeing the degree of enthusiasm for Trump versus Clinton was a little bit telling. So there is something to be said for being out here and really getting a sense of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wayne, thanks for that call. I'm turning now to Pat in Upper Arlington. Hi, Pat. You're on the air.
Yes. I wanted to discuss Roe v. Wade, and I wanted to remind people that when it passed, it was that 5 out of the 7 justices that voted for it were all nominated by Republican presidents. And then when it came up again in the 90s, which would have been, it was Casey versus Planned Parenthood, mm-hmm. which would have been a perfect time to repeal it because 8 of the 9 justices, keep that in mind, 8 out of the 9 had all been appointed by Republicans, and they had a perfect, it was a perfect time to overturn it, but it didn't happen. They passed a 24-hour waiting period,
right.
Parental notification.
Well, they gave the states the rights to.
They tweaked it in a lot of ways, but they did not repeal it.
Okay, so I guess the question then is, what about that? I mean, can he change the makeup of the court just by having a Republican nominee? Doesn't necessarily, but the list he put out there is pretty conservative.
Yeah, I mean, not necessarily. To answer the question, the list is conservative. You're right. But not necessarily. You can't really necessarily predict. There were Republican justices who turned out to be very moderate and, in fact, swing votes on
right.
the court. However, if you're a conservative and you're voting on the issue of abortion, you're going to hedge your bets. And to them, he's their bet.
Well, and they have become shrewder, the conservative Republican administrations, about their picks. The last real disaster was David Souter, who was picked towards the end of the George Bush Sr.
That's
administration.
Right.
And I literally met Justice Souter in the first week that he was on the court because I was at an event at the Supreme Court, and there he was. And we're both kind of bookish people from New England, so we actually stood in one corner and chatted. And my impression was he's not going to do anything that of what they want. And so one of the ways they've gotten shrewder, and some of the state Republican parties do this with respect to the state Supreme Court on these reproductive rights issues, is they have been a stronger and stronger preference for conservative white Catholics mm-hmm. because they are the most reliable jurists as a demographic
like
group.
Scalia.
Correct.
Whose own son is a priest.
Right. And also the Ohio Supreme Court has this mm-hmm. quality as well. And so they've figured out that if they pick sort of mainline Protestant Republican appointees, they're much more of a gamble on Roe and Roe-related issues.
Okay.
And so having learned from that experience, I suspect that Donald Trump will pick Scalia-like people. But they have to leave the court. In other words, there is a vacancy, and that was Scalia's seat. That doesn't change anything if mm-hmm. you put Scalia Jr. in there. They need more vacancies. But now people live much longer. It's a mm-hmm. lifetime appointment. I suspect that the liberal justices are highly motivated to keep on living.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
All right, Pat. Thanks for that call. Emily in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Emily.
Hi there. I'm hearing this message today that Donald Trump is rewriting the way things are done, and I'm personally fear deeply that the reason that he won was a response to some of the hateful messages we heard from him. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I'm wondering if really we actually aren't changing anything, that this is inevitable to kind of take away the presidency from the incumbent party. And really what we learned is that we could just plug anyone in that spot and they would have done it.
Hmm. So you're just saying that it's just this natural, okay, we had a Democrat in power in the Oval Office for 8 years. Now we're just going to put the Republican in, who's ever next in line. Jessica Wehrman, does that feel like it's the case for you this time around? I know what she's talking about.
I do.
But
I mean, and I think, you know, the thing I heard from people about why is this happening is because of a real desire for change. If you look at the exit polls, we've already just sort of discredited the exit polls, but I do believe this. I believe that there was
but change,
a group of people
but they
who really,
kept Congress in
they kept
almost
Congress,
practically the same.
But you also have to look at, on the House level, there's gerrymandering that is
right.
so significant. I mean, these, you know, our own Ohio congressional delegation, but last time I looked, no, they all won by 60%.
Yeah.
The Senate is a little bit harder, and it's you have to really kind of take that on a case-by-case mm-hmm. basis. So it's kind of, I'm actually putting them to the side. To me, the presidency is sort of the symbol.
Right.
This is the change. They see in him somebody who could change. Now, are there people who his rhetoric appealed to them? Absolutely. But I think that to just say everyone, that rhetoric appealed to everybody who voted for him probably sort of oversimplifies matters. I think that the desire to change really trumped any sort of concern that some of these voters had about his rhetoric.
Emily, thanks a lot for that call. I wanted to squeeze in one more here. David from Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, David.
Yeah, hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm from England originally, and I was fearing that the pollsters were getting it drastically wrong because of experience, obviously, with Brexit, but also with Thatcher in the 80s, whenever it was, 90s. Nobody wanted Thatcher. No one voted for her. That's what the polls continually told us.
And yet, there she was.
And yet, every time there was an election, she won. Mm-hmm. So my fear was, you know, that the pollsters were getting it drastically wrong. And as the night progressed, well, my fears grew.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. David Stubbin, you've already compared and contrasted with England.
That's right. There is a middle England, just as there is a middle America. And the quality of life in those worlds, for whites especially, has gone down a lot in significant ways since the 1970s, and especially since the 90s. And so oftentimes the people who are most motivated to vote are the most aggrieved. Mm-hmm. And that's where the intensity came from. And if you make those people happier, then the more negative aspects of their personalities and rhetoric will diminish.
We're now being told that Hillary Clinton will be speaking minutes from now. We don't know how many minutes, but I just want to give our listeners a heads up on that, that we'll switch very quickly. We will return to our conversation. But just in case I don't have time to say goodbye to Jessica Wehrman before the end of the hour, thank you so much for joining us. You drove here all the way from Dayton today after staying up pretty much all night, and we really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, and thank caffeine.
Yeah. Thank good old fashioned caffeine. David Stubbin, you're going to stay with us, and I'm not saying goodbye yet, but I'm just saying that we may be turning to New York and Hillary Clinton's remarks any minute now. So stay for that. President Obama's invited Donald Trump to the White House. This is kind of typical. I think much was made of it when George W. Bush invited the Obamas to the White House, and they were very impressed by the transition of power and how gracious the Bushes were. They've mentioned it a few times, and I think now he's he's going to do the same thing for the next successor, Donald Trump. What happens in a place like that? What happens at a time like that, Jessica Wehrman? It's this Thursday.
I know. And
it's
there was
tomorrow.
So much. Yeah. I mean, he's actually going to meet the Cleveland Cavaliers on Thursday as well. So it's going to be a big day for President Obama. I think that it's going to be a little awkward because, I mean, as you remember, towards the end of the campaign, President Obama was kind of the leading watchdog. Attack dog.
Yeah.
Sorry. This is where the exhaustion sets in.
I was nodding when you were saying watchdog.
Yeah, we were like, you understood
yeah,
me.
I get you.
it's got to happen. I think that they're going to have to put things aside. And I think the time for, you know, a peaceful transition of powers has come. I mean, it's time to put it all in the past, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there is a very strong sense in both parties and on both campaigns that the country is more divided as mm-hmm. a result of this campaign and
right.
election.
Yeah.
And so we can't really accomplish much if we are divided right down the middle. And we have a lot of problems, foreign and domestic, that need addressing. And so that is the glue that should hold these sorts of events together, this overall sense that we actually need to put out some public display of unity for the outside world and to encourage that kind of behavior among the American people. It will be a very awkward meeting, however, because they've said very nasty things about each other for a long time, and there is no chemistry. In other words, there's no natural...
No beer summit.
Right. And they don't have much in common. That's the easiest way to put it, President Obama and Donald Trump. They're very different people. So, but both of them feel compelled to do this, and there's a script, and they'll follow the script.
I guess I would have thought that George W. Bush and Obama were very different people, too, but this puts a new face on different.
It actually makes them look quite united.
Exactly. Again, Jessica Wehrman, thanks so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
And Dave Stubin, professor of history and law at Ohio State University, thanks to you as well. We'll be following up in a little bit.
You're welcome.
Thanks to the ALSI staff for helping us put everything together. Producer Michael DeBonis, assistant producer Shia Lanat were here with me last night for our live show. ALSI's interns, Walter Hopp, Jessica Shakespeare, and Shelby Powers, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.